Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, July 14th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me today from the Cape Cod Times newsroom is Sean Driscoll. Hi, Sean.
Good morning.
And joining us a little bit later will be Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We hear from Jim DiArruda of the New Bedford Standard Times. Joshua Balling is calling in from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Ann Wood will join us from the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now we'll look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Let's start, Sean, with what really appears to be a major turn in a story that's been going on for many years. Selectmen in the town of Falmouth announced this week that they're not going to appeal a judge's decision ordering them to shut down two wind turbines.
That's right, Steve. And just to give you an idea of how long this has been going on, I think Christine Lashier is the third Falmouth reporter to cover the story since it began. But you're right. Monday night, the Board of Selectmen had an executive session and then later announced in open session that they are not going to appeal a judge's decision ordering them to shut down the town's two wind turbines, which have caused controversy pretty much since they were turned on. This has been, they've been in battles over this since 2010, 2011, and have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees for outside attorneys to handle much of this work. But the chairwoman of the Board of Selectmen, Sue Moran, said that the litigation has divided the community and diverted resources, and it's time to put the matter behind the town and move forward.
I think this really surprised a lot of folks that this is the turn the story's taken now.
It surprised me. I covered it for several years, sort of in the middle relief section of the reporter roster here. And I think it was a surprise, especially to the abutters, the neighbors of the turbines who have been, you know, leading this fight. Some of them told Christine Legere this week that they're almost hesitant to accept this announcement because they've been optimistic in the past and then found out they've had to fight some more. A lot of these neighbors have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees. And, you know, they're a little skittish to believe that this might actually be the end, or at least the beginning of the end of this process. But there's also, of course, the, as it turns out, $12 million question of what this will cost the town, because they took out loans on both of these turbines or got other funding that now maybe have to be repaid. And it could cost, you know, at least $1 million to take these things down, since they won't be running. They don't want to leave them there, obviously. So there are still lots of questions still to be answered in this matter.
The town's still on the hook for money that it borrowed from the state to put these turbines up.
Yeah, that's right. For Wind One, they owe the state loans and commitments total about $6.25 million. On Wind Two, almost $5 million, with the possibility of interest tacked on. And these are loans that some of them on Wind 2, at least, was going to be forgiven if the turbine continued to operate and to generate electricity. And, of course, that's not going to happen. And then, of course, the cost of dismantling and removing the devices at least is in $1 million job. And the town is working with the State Clean Energy Center and the Clean Water Trust on the matter of those financial obligations, the town manager said, and trying to get some relief there from the state that financed them in the first place.
I saw it noted that if this goes through, Falmouth may be the first municipality, perhaps nationwide, to decommission one of its turbines, or both its turbines, I guess, here.
Yeah, I mean, and these kind of went up at a unique time for wind energy in the country. I mean, there was a lot of excitement about them in municipal, you know, settings, and these were certainly two very large turbines, and as it turned out, you know, it seems clear now that they were sited improperly and too close to the homes. And I think Falmouth sort of turned into a cautionary tale for a lot of towns and areas across the country who are thinking about doing this, and sort of galvanized a lot of, you know, response to it. And certainly we have other issues with turbines going on in Bourne and Plymouth right now. So if this, you know, it does seem that this will be the first, you know, of its case, if these do get taken down ultimately, that happens in the country, but may not be the last.
And I guess even if it's the end of the legal battle on this particular front, it's certainly not the end of the story, and we'll be following this going forward.
Absolutely.
Turning to the next story, the owners of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth have asked for an exemption so they won't have to comply with cybersecurity rules.
That's right, and this is actually, you know, would be the third extension of this exemption that's been going back, you know, since the first exemption was in 2014, but it's back in the news again, obviously, because there were reports last week of hackers attempting to breach networks that are connected to nuclear power stations. And Pilgrim, which is set to close no later than June 1st of 2019, has been asking for exemptions from that, from the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And they gave them an extension in 2014 and then another one in 2016. And then right now they have a deadline of December 2017, but back in March they had requested a deadline extension to 2020, which would put it past the point where Pilgrim was shut down. So essentially it would never have to meet those requirements.
There are many, many concerns with Pilgrim. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has downgraded it to the level just above mandatory closing for being poorly operated.
Yeah, and those concerns have obviously been well documented, and it's you know, one of only three plants in the nation that are in that performance category. And it's, you know, it's worth noting that the hacking attempts that have happened weren't in systems that were connected to the operation of the plant. It was more the, you know, the financial side, you know, personnel databases, that sort of thing. But it's still obviously, when you hear the words hacking a nuclear power station in close proximity, it is obviously a concern for people. There is certainly, you know, the residents who are, you know, advocating, you know, against Pilgrim say that they should not, you know, just because they're shutting down, why should they get a pass? It's still two more years. And this, you know, all sort of came up in the wake of 9/11. And there's been sort of scattershot compliance with these at Pilgrim. And, well, I don't know if I'd say scattershot, but they have requested these waivers. And, you know, especially in light of them closing, they're looking to not have to do it at all.
I want to turn now to Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Sarah, the state has notified the sheriff that the community corrections program on the island is going to be eliminated. Can you start by explaining what this program is?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the office here on the island that provides services like counseling, education, job placement, things like that for people who have been are on probation, and that could either be after serving a sentence in the House of Correction, or sometimes people are placed on probation in lieu of serving time. And they also do things like electronic monitoring. They run the community service if that's part of a sentence, and also drug and alcohol testing. So kind of a lot of different things that are run out of that office. And like you said, this week the word came in that the program is here on the island is slated for elimination. It sounds like it would be shut down by August 31st. And the program as a whole has a budget of, I think, $295,000. And the reason behind the cut, according to, you know, the state executive director of community corrections for all the different programs, is that the overall state budget has an operating deficit. And here on the Vineyard, there's a relatively small number of people placed on probation out of the court here compared to elsewhere in the state. And I think the number was that there are fewer than 50 people on probation on the island right now. So the state is spending a relatively large amount of money on each person because it's a program with fewer people. And it sounds like the state would continue to provide some funding for the community service aspect, about $50,000. It's not really clear how the other parts of the program, like the electronic monitoring, things like that, would be sorted out. It sounds like maybe some of those things would be shifted to the probation department at the court here. The state angle is that this is, you know, they were kind of looking at what programs are used the most and trying to deal with this budget deficit. Here on the island, there has been some, you know, strong criticism, especially from the county sheriff, Robert Ogden. And he said, you know, first that he feels this is an important program in terms of the emphasis on things like reducing opioid addiction, rehabilitation, diverting people from the House of Corrections, and also providing a way for people who are on, I think as he put it, the wrong side of the law, to, you know, right the ship and to get back on track with some support and a system in place. And he also pointed out, you know, his argument was that taxpayers and residents here deserve these services in the community, even if there happens to be a smaller number of people living here. Mm-hmm. So, and a spokesman, too, for the state senator, Julian Sear, you know, also weighed in, and they kind of called on the Office of Probation to really give a strong justification for eliminating the program. So, you know, as of now, you know, we haven't heard that anything's changing, but I suppose there is always, you know, a chance that something might be worked out. But for now, this is a program that looks like it might be going away from the island.
August 31st is just 6 weeks away. That's soon.
Yeah, it is. And the person, the special sheriff who runs the program here said, you know, he's kind of in a holding pattern, you know, unclear about how some of these functions will be handled. And yeah, like you said, just 6 weeks. So we'll certainly be, you know, looking at how this shakes out and what it means for people here on the island if this happens or in what form it takes.
Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, thanks for joining with us.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Mm-hmm. Sean, I want to turn to one more story here. A new audit has found that the Barnstable County is in what appears to be some bad real estate deals where it's not really getting the value maybe it should from its properties. What can you tell us about this?
That's right. Well, the county administrator, Jack Units, has said this is sort of ahead of an audit that's going to be released by the state auditor's office in a few weeks, that the county has entered into what appear to be voidable leases with several entities, giving them basically free rent, a dollar a year or less, for long-term leases on county-owned land that were not properly done in the first place. Apparently, under Massachusetts law, any real estate offered for sale or lease by the county has to be offered to the state first and then to the town in which the property is located. In this case, it would be Bourne. And then they have to be properly appraised to determine market value before they can enter into a contract. And this never seems to have happened. So in Bourne, there's property that Gosnold has leased, senior living residences of Cape Cod, AmeriCorps, the Bourne Society for Historic Preservation's Valley Farm Thrift Shop, which is a lot to say, until recently, Elder Services of the Cape Cod and Islands. So this is obviously the county's not in great financial shape. I mean, they have $1 million from its operating budget for the upcoming fiscal year and just agreed to a multi-$1 million water contamination settlement with the town of Barnstable. So they're not exactly in a position to be offering free rent. So the you know, they're going to have to look at these leases and either renegotiate them or, you know, get, you know, perhaps get rid of those tenants. I mean, it's really unclear as far as what's going to happen at this point. But it seems clear that these and others that we found under an independent review were not properly executed in the first place.
I guess there's a lot of questions really about the process and the transparency of how these leases came about. But it also looks like some of these are nonprofits providing public services and would maybe not be able to meet market rate either. So,
I mean, you know, sure. I mean, Gosnold is a nonprofit, but obviously they're a large operation. But, you know, senior living residences of Cape Cod, they, you know, house people, and I don't know that Gosnold could, but, you know, just, you know, for sort of two ends of the spectrum, you've got Gosnold on the one side and then AmeriCorps, which doesn't have a huge budget. You know, I'm assuming the Bourne Society for Historic Preservation probably doesn't either. So there are sort of this range of entities that are on these properties, and then Cape Cod Organic Farm seems to be in that group too, with a lease in Barnstable on Route 6A. So, I mean, the question is, you know, where would these people go and could they afford, you know, market rate rent? And I don't know that necessarily the county would have to charge market rate rent, but they have to go through this process before they make that decision. And the state and Bourne would have to pass on those properties. And at least, you know, some of the selectmen that we talked to in Bourne said that mm-hmm. they might want to take a second look at that to see if those are properties that they would want to add to their collection. And if they did, then maybe they would negotiate these leases with them. I mean, there are a lot of different paths that this could take, but something is going to change on this in the near future because the state is about to, you know, ding them for all these leases. And this is a review that Jack Units asked for when he was hired last year, it should be noted. So this isn't coming out of nowhere. He wanted an overall mm-hmm. review of the operations and their property, and this is how this came up.
You are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll have more just ahead. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker, and joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Sean Driscoll. And on the phone with us now is Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, Chatham has a drawbridge that's basically brand new, but it's not working so well. In fact, it's sticking. Is that right?
That's exactly right. It's this $14 million Mitchell River drawbridge opened just a year ago. And this week, town officials acknowledged that they're having some sticking problems with the draw span, which doesn't close properly. And sometimes they even have to, in order to get it closed, they have to drive a truck over it to lock it into place, which is, of course, not the way the bridge was designed, and it doesn't help the operation at all. Now, this bridge was built with state and federal money, and both the contractor and the state engineers have been down to look at the issue. They did some minor tinkering with it, but it's still happening. Local officials think that the problem here lies with the Cape's notoriously humid summer weather. Listeners may recall that this bridge was the new one replaced an old wooden drawbridge, which was said to be the last all-wooden drawbridge in the country. And the state originally had proposed to replace that with an all-concrete bridge, sort of recognizing the environment it resides in. But to satisfy preservationists, the final design included a wooden deck on top of a concrete superstructure. Now, that hybrid design appears to have contributed to this problem, according to town officials. What happens is the deck swells and the pins don't line up accurately when they're supposed to lock into place when it's lowered. Now, this glitch hasn't really prevented officials from being able to raise and lower the span so that boats can pass underneath it. But, you know, this was supposed to be a state-of-the-art mechanism, and clearly the design has some kind of flaws in it. They're still trying to identify exactly what those flaws are. Now, at this point, the town hasn't formally accepted the bridge from the contractor, and town officials say that they're not going to do that until this problem is solved.
You have another story in the ongoing saga of people attempting to steal or vandalize the artwork sharks in the park, and now it seems like the town may be stepping up its game here.
Yeah, it's the Sharks in the Park exhibit is put out by the Chatham Merchants Association. For those who don't know, these are 5-foot sharks that are painted and decorated by local artists. Now, in three incidents this summer, sharks have been stolen. They've all been recovered, but the most recent one was a little more lively and interesting than the previous ones. This happened in the early morning hours of July 4th. Now, there's video monitoring the sharks 24 hours a day, and about 1 a.m., Alex Hillman, whose mother, Janice Rogers, oversees the exhibit for the merchants, and she lives across the street from the Elders Library, where the sharks are currently exhibited. Alex was about to put chairs out for the 4th of July parade the next day when his girlfriend glanced at the security video, and she saw three men walking away with one of the sharks. And Alex told us that he was just kind of tired of people doing that, so he rushed out, he grabbed the shark from the man who was carrying it, and then chased him through some backyards until the police arrived. And the police were able to positively identify the man through the video footage, and so they've charged a 21-year-old Bellingham man with wanton destruction of property. And the merchants hope that the fact that somebody's been charged is going to discourage any further mischief regarding these sharks. And they also say that they're examining additional security measures, including putting GPS trackers on the sharks to try to discourage this theft further.
It's not enough we're trying to track sharks in the water. You now have to track your artwork sharks, yes?
You have to track them on the land, too, you know?
Okay, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
I want to turn to Jim DiRuta of the New Bedford Standard Times, who joins us on the phone. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Three schools in Wareham were evacuated this week because of an anonymous email that they received threatening violence.
Yes, on Monday, about 10 a.m., the police department actually was the recipient of an email that said that there was going to be a shooter at a school, but didn't specify which school. And because all three schools were being used for various summer sessions, whether summer school or there was a basketball camp going on at one of the schools, they were serving about 500 students that day in the three schools. So, you know, the superintendent got in touch with the principals, and they started to help the children, the students, shelter. And in one case, the basketball camp counselor said he was instructed by a principal to shelter in the locker room. Eventually, all the students were escorted in groups out of the respective buildings, and they were sent by bus to the YMCA in Wareham, where they were, you know, given water and juice. And I guess the younger students were told that they were just getting an impromptu visit to the Y. And their parents picked them up, and things were okay. But they're still investigating and trying to track it down and get the source. A number of regional SWAT teams were involved. Other local departments were used in mutual aid. State police were involved with dogs, and it was quite extensive.
The scale of the response was impressive. Like you say, the SWAT teams and tactical team from the state police, and the footage and the photographs you guys had, it was impressive to see that much police and almost military presence in front of the schools.
Indeed, the coordination was very effective, and thankfully, so far it appears it was a hoax, and there, you know, trauma response wasn't required, but the emergency response was praised.
It was a hoax, but alarming and scary I'm sure, for the children to be on lockdown, for the parents when they're not sure what's happening.
Indeed, and these things aren't forgotten by the children either. And in a way, it brings some experience about this world that they didn't have before. But in another way, it takes away something that they did have.
Mm-hmm. Jim DiArruda of the New Bedford Standard Times, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Sean, I want to go to a story about, it was a big story this week about a boat fire, a big blaze in Falmouth Harbor. A boat caught fire overnight. It was a large boat, and we have more information today about the couple who were on board.
That's right. There's a 60-foot catamaran called the Best Revenge 5 that caught fire quite spectacularly Tuesday morning, about 1:45 in the morning. And there were two people who were on board. One of them, a woman who we now know is named Lucy Fletcher, was flown to a Boston hospital for treatment of second and third degree burns, and had earlier been listed in stable condition. But today we have a story about a GoFundMe, an online fundraiser for Lucy Fletcher and Nicholas Baxter, who were the two people who were living on the boat as crew members, and are now homeless because they're essentially their house burned down. And about $30,000 had been raised for them just as of Thursday afternoon. I didn't check it this morning before I came in here. But, they're both from South Africa. They're not local on any stretch of the imagination, although the boat has come here the last few summers. So they do have a friend in Pocasset who set up this GoFundMe page to support them. And it's been, they posted some updates on it. And as of Thursday morning, Baxter said that Fletcher was comfortable and the hospital staff was taking amazing care of her. So luckily she seems to be holding her own at Brigham and Women's Hospital right now. But the fire was quite large. It was a three-alarm fire, brought help from the Joint Base and Kituit and Mashpee. And there was a large fuel spill involved, so it was quite a spectacle out there the night that it happened.
I think it was amazing that the damage was only limited to this boat when you see the pictures and the size of this fire.
Yeah, there was some heat damage to a couple of the surrounding boats, but when you think about it, that it didn't spread further if it had been a windier night, perhaps it would have been, could possibly have been even worse. And then obviously to get the boat out is a little bit of a a task as well. I think that Sito had to use a crane barge brought in from somewhere else because it was too big for a travel crane to lift. They obviously have an environmental cleanup to do because quite a lot of diesel fuel spilled in the harbor. So obviously it could have been a lot worse, but it still was, you know, pretty bad, and a lot of environmental issues that they're going to be monitoring there. I know that they had closed shellfishing beds as a result of the fuel spill. So certainly will be sort of an ongoing issue for a while. And the state fire marshal did say after this that it's focused on an accidental cause. So at least at this point, there doesn't seem to be any intent behind the fire.
Okay, the fire in Falmouth Harbor this week. I want to go now to Josh Balling, who is joining us from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. How are you, Josh?
I'm well, thanks.
Josh, what do you have for us here, Josh, the first story?
Well, I've got a pretty big story about National Grid worried that the backup power supply on the island might not be enough if one of the two undersea cables that serves the island were to go down at the height of the summer. The demand on only one cable, if the other cable goes down, exceeds currently the capacity of that cable, and the backup generation that National Grid has out here is not up to par in their standards as well. There's some deteriorating generators, they don't put out enough power, and there could be rolling brownouts, there could be power outages if one of those cables were to go down, and it's happened before, not at the height of the summer, but over the winter and once when one of the transfer stations on the other side went down as well. So National Grid is proposing a major replacement and expansion of the backup power generation that will hopefully take care of that. They want to build that on their existing site out by Nantucket Memorial Airport. It's all part of a larger plan to address the power needs of the island moving forward for the next 20 years or so. If the demand continues to increase the way it has, which is about five times the state average, Nantucket would probably be looking at the need for a third undersea cable to supply power to the island, and that would probably cost about $75 to $100 million to put in and take years of permitting and construction. So National Grid and the island officials are doing what they can to try and put that off or maybe potentially even eliminate it through a number of programs, energy conservation programs, looking at alternate energy forms like solar battery storage out here. And this generator project is related to but separate in some ways from that, so that just to make sure that the island has backup power when it needs it, particularly in the summer.
You had a stabbing on the island this week that sounds like it was quite violent.
It was. It stemmed from a party in a warehouse in the Mid-Island area, and an Essex Road man is currently in custody after he was found to be a danger to the community for his involvement in this stabbing. He allegedly stabbed another man during this party, and that man was found by police outside the warehouse in some bushes, clinging to life. He was stabbed eight times, and this man, Kadeem Ferguson of Essex Road, was charged with assault with intent to murder, mayhem, and eight counts of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. And he's currently being held and being considered a danger to the community pending another pretrial hearing back on Nantucket on Monday.
And Josh, briefly, whales spotted quite close to shore. This must have been exciting.
It certainly was and still is. Whales are not necessarily unusual off Nantucket, but usually you've got to be in a boat or up high to see them further offshore. They were within a few hundred yards of the beach on the south shore for most of the week. Some of them are still there, maybe 15 to 20 whales, a mix of humpback whales, which are, you know, relatively common, and the much more endangered right whales. It was at least two or three, maybe more right whales mixed in with this pod of whales that people on the beach could see with the naked eye and get very good glimpses with binoculars. Officials are saying, please, that you know, stay away from them with boats. If you can't come anywhere closer than 500 yards of a right whale and 100 yards of a humpback whale under federal regulations, or you could face some pretty stiff penalties. So watch them from the beach, but don't get any closer than that, they're saying.
Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And I want to jump right over to Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. The year 2020 is coming up, and that marks the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims landing here. There's some question about what preparations the town is making for this event.
So the Pilgrims landed in Provincetown Harbor. For those who still think they landed in Plymouth, not true. Landed in Provincetown. And the town's always been sort of sensitive about that. At the beginning of the 20th century, the Pilgrim Monument was constructed on the highest hill here so that from afar land and sea, you could see that the Pilgrims landed here and not Plymouth. But apparently, or it seems, we're a little bit behind Plymouth in the 2020 celebrations. What happened is, for years now, the town's been talking about the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims Landing here and how important it is, and they signed the Mayflower Compact in our harbor. And but it's been a lot of talk, and no real action had taken place until about 2012, when Anthony Fucillo was hired as the town's tourism director, and the selectmen asked him what he was going to do. He decided to start gathering some tourism funds and squirreled away $75,000 in 5 years to go towards the celebration. And they also, he also, with Selectman Cheryl Andrews, started a group that became known as the Provincetown 400 Task Force, which was supposed to help in the planning and preparations for a huge celebration in 2020. But the task force wasn't really able to go it alone. So the town decided, and the task force decided, that it should hire an executive director for Provincetown 400.
Mm-hmm.
So the executive director they hired in October 2016 is Lisa Giuffre. Now, Lisa Giuffre has not been doing much, as far as we can tell. I've been talking and investigating this story for a couple months now and talking to people around town, and nobody knows really exactly what she's done. She herself has admitted that she has no events listed on the 2020 calendar, but she claims that there are things on the horizon and that she's going to let people know in September, October what's happening, and people are going to be very enthusiastic. She won't talk about her salary or how much money's been raised either, and has never met with the Board of Selectmen. I went and visited with her in her office on Friday, and it's empty. And finally, I got news the same day, later that day, I believe, that she is, and her board is going in front of the Board of Selectmen on July 24th. She asked me to not write a story or publish a story until after that, when she claimed there'd be more information. But many people in town have been speculating about what's going on, and it seems there's no solid plans, and people are a bit worried about it.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a big event across the state, obviously.
It is across the state. In fact, there is a Boston commission, which is called the Plymouth 400th Anniversary Commission. They're calling it Plymouth 400th Anniversary Commission, so it's supposed to include the entire state, because State Representative Sarah Peake said the Plymouth applied for the nonprofit status first. And the state has given the commission, the state commission, $200,000 for the 2020 celebration, Peake said. And she thinks Provincetown will see some of that. But the reason why it's a statewide event is because the Pilgrims came here first in November 1620. Then they went to Plymouth, but then other cities and around the area and towns are going to start having their 400th anniversary. So after 2020, the state expects that it's going to just go from town to town and expanded celebrations. So it should be fun, and we hope that there are things happening that we're just not hearing about yet. We look forward to the meeting on July 24th, and hopefully Giuffre will give us some answers and some solid sort of celebration things that are happening. Although we do know that there's going to be, she says, there's going to be three major Provincetown events in 2020, one in May or June, one in late August, and the third in November, when the Pilgrims actually landed here. So we'll see what she has to say. Stay tuned on that.
Well, you'll keep us updated, I'm sure. Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, thanks for joining us.
Hey, take care.
You are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We'll have more just ahead. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We are discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Sean Driscoll. Sean, last week on the roundup, we talked about the uproar on Mayflower Beach in Dennis, where some teenagers were allegedly engaged in public sex in the middle of the day. The whole event got kind of very big in terms of the attention it received, and now it seems to be catalyzing folks in Dennis.
It does. There was a Board of Selectmen meeting this week in Dennis that brought about 60 people out to voice concerns about the overall condition of the beaches, beyond sort of this 4th of July incident that brought international media attention to poor little Dennis. There were obviously five, as we all know, probably by now, five teenagers arrested after four were allegedly seen having sex in the water. Police didn't see it when they got there, but they ignored orders to leave the area, which is why they ended up being arrested. And residents who showed up at this meeting said that beaches have just been increasingly more rowdy and that this is just the tipping point. This is not happening out of nowhere. that it's been a problem that's been escalating for more than 10 years. And there's this image of the Bayside beaches that are, you know, it's rowdy and sort of uncontrolled, and that it's turned into an embarrassment for the town, obviously, in light of this incident that just spread everywhere after the 4th of July. I mean, it was, you know, we had a lot of interest in the story, and I know a lot of other people did too. So, you know, the town is going to, has cracked down. They had more enforcement over this past weekend, checking for alcohol as they were coming in, and they're going to make up a committee to discuss solutions to these problems. But, the residents are not amused, as one might imagine, and, are looking for a long-term solution to what they say has been, this sort of persistent issue.
I want to turn to George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Steve. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. George, when talking about the uptick in great white sharks, Chatham seems to get a lot of attention. But I understand there's a new buoy off of Martha's Vineyard which should help track sharks swimming around the island.
That's right. And let's set the record straight here. Where was Jaws filmed? Martha's Vineyard.
You're going to claim that right off the top. Okay.
Absolutely. And so there is a lot of interest in finding out, you know, sharks swim in the ocean, obviously, and they're not just swimming in Chatham. So how many of them are making their way to the shores off of Martha's Vineyard? And we're going to get a chance to find out. Greg Skolmel and his team have deployed a buoy off of South Beach. And it's not there by accident. There have been sightings there by planes going up from Katamit Airfield. And so, you know, they're going to collect data from the sharks that have already been tagged. There's been 110 great whites that have been tagged by Skolmel since he started this program back in 2009. This story all came about because he's going to be coming over here to the island to give a little talk in August, and so folks are looking forward to that. And probably at the end of the summer, we'll find out, you know, get some information about whether some of these tagged sharks are making their way over here.
All right. The Coast Guard, meanwhile, this year has really been pushing paddlecraft safety, that's boating safety for things like kayaks. And there's been plenty in the news these days to support this idea.
Yeah, so our reporter, Barry Stringfellow, had been researching, talking to the Coast Guard about this story about paddlecraft safety, and it seemed like every day we would get some alert from the Coast Guard that there was a missing kayaker somewhere. And just so happened, right before this story appeared, there was an incident at Nashawena, and you know, it just illustrates the reason why anybody going out on a paddlecraft, whether it be a paddleboard, a kayak, a canoe, should tell people where they're headed, and they should have, you know, they should register it with the Coast Guard, because if they go missing, the Coast Guard sends out, you know, one of their Jayhawk helicopters, mm-hmm. they send out their boats. It's incredibly expensive for them to go out. And sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, someone left one going adrift, but they still have to keep the search on until they can figure things out. In this case, you know, the person had a cell phone on board and a wallet on board. They were able to quickly find out who it was, and sure enough, they had given some indication of where they were going to be. All things that the Coast Guard, you know, says is important. It's a lengthy story. There's a lot of good detail in there. It also includes a video where one of our local paddlecraft experts, you know, talks to people about what they should be doing.
Sharks and paddlecraft, that's a combination, George.
Interesting combination.
George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times, thanks a lot.
Take care.
Sean, town of Falmouth has proposed, in the town of Falmouth, a proposed development on Main Street. It's been a source of a lot of controversy, has been given permitting approval by the town, but with a number of conditions. It doesn't seem at all clear how this is going to play out. This is Liberty Green.
No, and Chapter 3 of No One Knows What's Going to Happen in Falmouth on this week's news roundup. The Zoning Board of Appeals approved a permit for Liberty Green, which is this affordable housing project, a very big one on Main Street. Attached a long list of conditions to it to try to protect neighbors and preserve the character of the downtown area. Because of the low affordable housing stock in the town, which is not a condition uncommon in towns in Massachusetts, it would have been difficult for them to deny it outright. But neighbors were very concerned about the size of it, the massing, the proximity of it to their homes, traffic, a whole list of concerns. So they put many requirements into this permit that would force the developer to change their plans or to make other considerations. Now, of course, the developer can appeal this. They would appeal it to the Massachusetts Housing Appeals Committee because it's a affordable housing project. It's got a little bit of a different path than a traditional zoning appeal would, which would either go to land court or to Superior Court. And they've got, I believe, 20 or 30 days to do that. And then it would, you know, be appealed. There would be a hearing and sort of a rehear of this issue. The Zoning Board of Appeals has been hearing this for quite a while, had many, many meetings on it. But as you said, the issue is far from over.
And the board was pretty clear in saying that they felt this was kind of the best of a bad deal to give them the permit, but with these conditions.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the chairwoman said that they thought that the permit protected the neighbors more than a denial, because if they denied it outright, it would be approved without conditions, and they could basically do whatever they wanted to do. So they tried to make the project the best that they could to make the project fit with the town, and they didn't give Falmouth Hospitality, the developer, all the waivers that they wanted. They did some of them, and you know, they made the best out of it that they could to sort of split the difference. But I don't think either side will be particularly pleased with it. So I'm sure that there will be, appeals of this. But as far as we know right now, nothing has been filed. But we're still in that window.
In another story on development that has controversy around it, the Cape Cod Commission is going to weigh in on a proposed Dollar General store for East Ham. There's been a lot of resistance to this proposal from some folks in the town.
That's right. This is a store that would go on Route 6 next to Castaway Marine. Now, the store is 9,100 square feet, and that's below the 10,000 square foot trigger that would automatically send a commercial development to the commission. But the town requested a review, arguing that the store did not fit in with the village style. You know, this rectangular store didn't fit in with sort of the village aesthetic. And then it would have impact on traffic on the corridor there, which has a lot of curb cuts, a lot of people coming in and out. Then that's something else that they're trying to fix. But there's a couple of matters there that they wanted review. The commission voted to accept the review, so that stops the local zoning process and sends it over to the commission. And that can take, you know, upwards of 6 or 7 months to carry out. They'll have their own study, and the developer will have to submit plans and hearings and et cetera. So it stops the local process and sends it to the commission, which is the Cape Wide planning body.
Sean, I want to jump to a story you reported this week about federal funding coming to the region for transportation issues.
That's right. The RTA is sort of the designated agent for federal funding that comes from the Federal Transit Administration, and it's based on a formula that takes into account data including passengers that are carried, miles traveled in what's called the urbanized zone, which is the fancy name for the Cape and a little bit of the area off the Cape. And the data had usually come from the RTA and also the Plymouth and Brockton and Peter Pan bus lines. But in cooperation with the Steamship Authority, now they're adding in the passenger traffic from the ferry lines and from, you know, the miles traveled, and that is going to bring an extra $3 million this year in transportation funding thanks to that. And I mean,
that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is a lot of money. That'll be a total of $12 million this year from, you know, $9 million. So And I mean, the steamship carried 3.1 million passengers last year. You know, it's more than double what the, or about just about double what the transit authority did. So, you know, the, it was certainly a big boost. It, it wasn't an easy process because it's the federal government, so it's not as easy as filling out a form and sending it online. So there was quite a lot of math sort of and work involved in the steamship authority's part. But the money that comes in is for regional planning issues, regional transit issues, capital stuff, you know, bigger projects. So the steamship general manager told me that they thought that it would help improve things in the Cape and that it was worth it for them in the grander scheme to help bring in more money to improve things overall.
Down on the Cape Cod Canal in Sandwich, the power plant expansion proposed there has cleared a big regulatory hurdle, it looks like.
Yes, the Energy's canal generating plant expansion, as you said, cleared a hurdle. The Energy Facilities Siting Board, which of course there is one, gave final approval for the construction of this 350-megawatt gas-fired turbine. The only change that they'll have to make is to increase the planned height of this exhaust deck by 30 feet for air quality reasons. But otherwise, they did get approval, and they're waiting on two other state permits. But it says that Energy says that they're on track to complete the turbine as scheduled and generate electricity in 2019. Now, this is going to be a supplemental thing that will fire up as needed. So it will be able to kick in as quickly as 10 minutes after they determine they need more electricity compared to 12 hours with the existing units. So it will, they say it will be a help as far as the, can, you know, keeping consistent electric supply to the area.
Yeah. That's the stack that's there is already a landmark. If it's higher, it's going to be even more visible, I guess.
Yeah, and the stack that they're going to add is about half the height of what's there now, so it's not going to be any taller. The town wanted it at the current height, but the state said you needed to bump it up a little bit, but it'll still be shorter than the current stack, okay. So it won't add to the overall height there.
The Cape Cod Playhouse, I want to turn to you guys. The Cape Cod Times, you had a series of stories on an investigative look at the Cape Cod Playhouse. This is a colorful old theater, but seems like there's a lot of questions about its management and really in what kind of shape the building itself is.
That's right, and there's the 30-second version of these two very comprehensive days of coverage. But Cape Playhouse is in its 91st summer, really trying to balance its history with a path going forward. There overall has not been a lot of money spent on improving the facilities, more just repairs as needed. And there's a lot of concern about the sustainability going forward. They've had a lot of turnover in staff and board members. And some people have expressed a lot of concern about the management there. And there is, you know, the board has, you know, says that they're optimistic about the future. But based on past performance, there is a lot of concern. They don't have a huge, you know, financial reserve. There's never been a capital campaign. The facilities are not in great shape. They got a $25,000 grant a few years ago from the state to determine what they needed to do, but they had to pass on the money because they couldn't get the $25,000 they needed to match it. So it's, you know, there have been a lot of questionable things going on, a lot of concern about the current state of it and how long it can sustain itself. And it is sort of this unique, you know, summer stock theater that has brought in, you know, huge names over the years and a lot of history there. And even the preservation of that history has been in, you know, it's been in concern in sort of their own archives. I mean, Betty Davis, Henry Fonda, Gregory Peck, Bogie was there.
So some amazing names.
Amazing names. Yes, unbelievable. I can't even fathom going to see Betty Davis on stage in Dennis. But, you know, I mean, it happened. So definitely a lot of
fun. We're going to have to leave it there, Sean. We should acknowledge for transparency that the Cape Playhouse is an underwriter of this station. I'm Steve Junker. That's the news roundup for the week. I want to thank Sean Driscoll at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Thanks to our other contributors, Sarah Brown, Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DiAruta from the New Bedford Standard Times, Josh Ballings, Nantucket Inquirer, Mira Ann Wood, and George Brennan. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.